Side 12. The City and the Stars and the Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke. Continuing with The Sands of Mars on page 477. Gibson walked over to the plot, keeping carefully to the narrow path. These plants weren't, after all, exactly the same as those he had discovered, though they had obviously descended from the same stock. The most surprising difference was the complete absence of gas pods, their place having been taken by myriads of minute pores. "This is the important point," said Hadfield. "We've bred a variety which releases its oxygen directly into the air because it doesn't need to store it any more. As long as it's got plenty of light and heat, it can extract all it needs from the sand and will throw off the surplus. All the oxygen you're breathing now comes from these plants. There's no other source in this dome."
"I see," said Gibson slowly.
"So you'd already thought of my idea, and gone a good deal further. But I still don't understand the need for all this secrecy."
"What secrecy?"
said Hadfield with an air of injured innocence.
"Really," protested Gibson. "You've just asked me not to say anything about this place."
"Oh, that's because there will be an official announcement in a few days, and we haven't wanted to raise false hopes. But there hasn't been any real secrecy."
Gibson brooded over this remark all the way back to Port Lowell. Hadfield had told him a good deal, but had he told him everything? Where, if at all, did Phobos come into the picture? Gibson wondered if his suspicions about the inner moon were completely unfounded. It could obviously have no connection with this particular project. He felt like trying to force Hadfield's hand by a direct question, but thought better of it. He might only make himself look a fool if he did. The domes of Port Lowell were climbing up over the steeply convex horizon when Gibson broached the subject that had been worrying him for the past fortnight.
"The Ares is going back to Earth in 3 weeks, isn't she?" he remarked to Hadfield. The other merely nodded. The question was obviously a purely rhetorical one, for Gibson knew the answer as well as anybody.
"I've been thinking," said Gibson slowly, "that I'd like to stay on Mars a bit longer. Maybe until next year."
"Oh?" said Hadfield. The exclamation revealed neither congratulation nor disapproval, and Gibson felt a little piqued that his shattering announcement had fallen flat.
"What about your work?" continued the chief. "All that can be done just as easily here as on Earth."
"I suppose you realize," said Hadfield, "that if you stay here, you'll have to take up some useful profession."
He smiled a little wryly.
"That wasn't very tactful, was it? What I mean is that you'll have to do something to help run the colony. Have you any particular ideas in this line?"
This was a little more encouraging. At least it meant that Hadfield had not dismissed the suggestion at once. But it was a point that Gibson had overlooked in his first rush of enthusiasm.
"I wasn't thinking of making a permanent home here," he said a little lamely. "But I want to spend some time studying the Martians, and I'd like to see if I can find any more of them. Besides, I don't want to leave Mars just when things are getting interesting."
"What do you mean?" said Hadfield swiftly.
"Why, these oxygen plants, and getting Dome 7 into operation. I want to see what comes of all this in the next few months."
Hadfield looked thoughtfully at his passenger. He was less surprised than Gibson might have imagined, for he had seen this sort of thing happen before. He had even wondered if it was going to happen to Gibson, and was by no means displeased at the turn of events. The explanation was really very simple. Gibson was happier now than he had ever been on Earth. He had done something worthwhile, and felt that he was becoming part of the Martian community. The identification was now nearly complete, and the fact that Mars had already made one attempt on his life had merely strengthened his determination to stay. If he returned to Earth, he would not be going home. He would be sailing into exile.
"Enthusiasm isn't enough, you know," said Hadfield.
"I quite understand that.
This little world of ours is founded on two things, skill and hard work. Without both of them, we might just as well go back to Earth. I'm not afraid of work,
and I'm sure I could learn some of the administrative jobs you've got here, and a lot of the routine technical ones."
This, Hadfield thought, was probably true. Ability to do these things was a function of intelligence, and Gibson had plenty of that. But more than intelligence was needed. There were personal factors as well. It would be best not to raise Gibson's hopes until he had made further inquiries and discussed the matter with Whittaker.
"I'll tell you what to do," said Hadfield. "Put in a provisional application to stay, and I'll have it signalled to Earth. We'll get their answer in about a week. Of course, if they turn you down, there's nothing we can do."
Gibson doubted this, for he knew just how much notice Hadfield took of terrestrial regulations when they interfered with his plans. But he merely said,
"And if Earth agrees, then I suppose it's up to you?"
"Yes. I'll start thinking about my answer then."
That, thought Gibson, was satisfactory as far as it went. Now that he had taken the plunge, he felt a great sense of relief, as if everything was now outside his control. He had merely to drift with the current, awaiting the progress of events. The door of the airlock opened before them, and the flea crunched into the city. Even if he had made a mistake, no great harm would be done. He could always go back to Earth by the next ship, or the one after. But there was no doubt that Mars had changed him. He knew what some of his friends would say when they read the news. "Have you heard about Martin? Looks as if Mars has made a man out of him. Who'd have thought it?" Gibson wriggled uncomfortably. He had no intention of becoming an elevating object lesson for anyone if he could help it. Even in his most maudlin moments, he had never had the slightest use for those smug Victorian parables about lazy, self-centered men becoming useful members of the community. But he had a horrible fear that something uncommonly like this was beginning to happen to him. Chapter 14.
"Out with it, Jimmy. What's on your mind? You don't seem to have much appetite this morning."
Jimmy toyed fretfully with the synthetic omelette on his plate, which he had already carved into microscopic fragments.
"I was thinking about Irene, and what a shame it is she's never had a chance of seeing Earth."
"Are you sure she wants to? I've never heard anyone here say a single good word for the place."
"Oh, she wants to, all right. I've asked her."
"Stop beating about the bush. What are you two planning now? Do you want to elope in the Aries?"
Jimmy gave a rather sickly grin.
"That's an idea, but it would take a bit of doing. Honestly, though, don't you think Irene ought to go back to Earth to finish her education? If she stays here, she'll grow up into a simple, unsophisticated country girl. A raw colonial?
Is that what you were thinking?"
"Well, something like that, but I wish you wouldn't put it so crudely."
"Sorry, I didn't mean to. As a matter of fact, I rather agree with you. It's a point that's occurred to me. I think someone ought to mention it to Hadfield."
"That's exactly what..."
began Jimmy excitedly.
"What you and Irene want me to do?"
Jimmy threw up his hands in mock despair.
"It's no good trying to kid you." "Yes."
"If you'd said that at the beginning, think of the time we'd have saved. But tell me frankly, Jimmy, just how serious are you about Irene?"
Jimmy looked back at him with a level, steadfast gaze that was in itself a sufficient answer.
"I'm dead serious. You ought to know that. I want to marry her as soon as she's old enough, and I can earn my living."
There was a dead silence, then Gibson replied,
"You could do a lot worse. She's a very nice girl. And I think it would do her a lot of good to have a year or so on Earth. Still, I'd rather not tackle Hadfield at the moment. He's very busy and, well, he's already got one request from me."
"Oh?"
said Jimmy, looking up with interest. Gibson cleared his throat.
"It's got to come out sometime, but don't say anything to the others yet. I've applied to stay on Mars."
"Good Lord!" exclaimed Jimmy. "That's, well, quite a thing to do."
Gibson suppressed a smile.
"Do you think it's a good thing?"
"Why, yes. I'd like to do it myself."
Even if Irene was going back to Earth? Asked Gibson dryly.
That isn't fair. But how long do you expect to stay?
Frankly, I don't know. It depends on too many factors. For one thing, I'll have to learn a job.
What sort of job?
Something that's congenial and productive. Any ideas?
Jimmy sat in silence for a moment, his forehead wrinkled with concentration. Gibson wondered just what he was thinking. Was he sorry that they might soon have to separate? In the last few weeks, the strain and animosities which had once both repelled and united them had dissolved away. They had reached a state of emotional equilibrium which was pleasant, yet not as satisfactory as Gibson would have hoped. Perhaps it was his own fault. Perhaps he had been afraid to show his deeper feelings and had hidden them behind banter and even occasional sarcasm. If so, he was afraid he might have succeeded only too well. Once he had hoped to earn Jimmy's trust and confidence. Now, it seemed, Jimmy only came to him when he wanted something. No, that wasn't fair. Jimmy certainly liked him, perhaps as much as many sons like their fathers. That was a positive achievement of which he could be proud. He could take some credit, too, for the great improvement in Jimmy's disposition since they had left Earth. He was no longer awkward and shy. Though he was still rather serious, he was never sullen. This, thought Gibson, was something in which he could take a good deal of satisfaction. But now there was little more he could do. Jimmy was slipping out of his world. Irene was the only thing that mattered to him now.
I'm afraid I don't seem to have any ideas, said Jimmy. Of course, you could have my job here. Oh, that reminds me of something I picked up in admin the other day.
His voice dropped to a conspiratorial whisper, and he leaned across the table.
Have you ever heard of Project Dawn?
No, what is it?
That's what I'm trying to find out. It's something very secret, and I think it must be pretty big.
Oh? Said Gibson, suddenly alert.
Perhaps I have heard about it after all.
Tell me what you know.
Well, I was working late one evening in the filing section and was sitting on the floor between some of the cabinets sorting out papers when the chief and Mayor Whittaker came in. They didn't know I was there and were talking together. I wasn't trying to eavesdrop, but you know how it is. All of a sudden, Mayor Whittaker said something that made me sit up with a bang. I think these were his exact words. Whatever happens, there's going to be hell to pay as soon as Earth knows about Project Dawn, even if it's successful. Then the chief gave a queer little laugh and said something about success excusing everything. That's all I could hear. They went out soon afterwards. What do you think about it?
Project Dawn.
There was a magic about the name that made Gibson's pulse quicken. Almost certainly it must have some connection with the research going on up in the hills above the city. But that could hardly justify Whittaker's remark. Or could it? Gibson knew a little about the interplay of political forces between Earth and Mars. He appreciated, from occasional remarks of Hadfield's and comments in the local press, that the colony was now passing through a critical period. On Earth, powerful voices were raised in protest against its enormous expense, which, it seemed, would extend indefinitely into the future with no sign of any ultimate reduction. More than once, Hadfield had spoken bitterly of schemes which he had been compelled to abandon on grounds of economy, and of other projects for which permission could not be obtained at all.
I'll see what I can find out from my, various sources of information, said Gibson. Have you mentioned it to anyone else?
No.
I shouldn't if I were you. After all, it may not be anything important. I'll let you know what I find out.
You won't forget to ask about Irene?
As soon as I get the chance. But it may take some time. I'll have to catch Hadfield in the right mood. As a private detective agency, Gibson was not a success. He made two rather clumsy direct attempts before he decided that the frontal approach was useless. George, the barman, had been his first target, for he seemed to know everything that was happening on Mars, and was one of Gibson's most valuable contacts. This time, however, he proved of no use at all.
Project Dawn? He said with a puzzled expression. I've never heard of it.
Are you quite sure? Asked Gibson, watching him narrowly.
George seemed to lose himself in deep thought.
Quite sure, he said at last, and that was that. George was such an excellent actor that it was quite impossible to guess whether he was lying or speaking the truth.
Gibson did a trifle better with the editor of the Martian Times. Westerman was a man he normally avoided, as he was always trying to coax articles out of him, and Gibson was invariably behind with his terrestrial commitments. The staff of Two, therefore, looked up with some surprise as their visitor entered the tiny office of Mars' only newspaper. Having handed over some carbon copies as a peace offering, Gibson sprang his trap.
I'm trying to collect all the information I can on Project Dawn, he said casually. I know it's still undercover, but I want to have everything ready when it can be published.
There was dead silence for several seconds. Then Westerman remarked, I think you'd better see the chief about that.
I didn't want to bother him, he's so busy, said Gibson innocently.
Well, I can't tell you anything.
You mean you don't know anything about it?
If you like. There are only a few dozen people on Mars who could even tell you what it is.
That, at least, was a valuable piece of information. Do you happen to be one of them? Asked Gibson.
Westerman shrugged his shoulders.
I keep my eyes open, and I've done a bit of guessing.
That was all that Gibson could extract from him. He strongly suspected that Westerman knew little more about the matter than he did himself, but was anxious to conceal his ignorance. The interview had, however, confirmed two main facts. Project Dawn certainly did exist, and it was extremely well hidden. Gibson could only follow Westerman's example, keeping his eyes open and guessing what he could. He decided to abandon the quest for the time being and to go round to the biophysics lab, where Squeak was the guest of honour. The little Martian was sitting on his haunches, taking life easily, while the scientists stood conversing in a corner, trying to decide what to do next. As soon as he saw Gibson, he gave a chirp of delight and bounded across the room, bringing down a chair as he did so, but luckily missing any valuable apparatus. The bevy of biologists regarded this demonstration with some annoyance. Presumably it could not be reconciled with their views on Martian psychology.
Well, said Gibson to the leader of the team, when he had disentangled himself from Squeak's clutches. Have you decided how intelligent he is yet?
The scientist scratched his head.
He's a queer little beast. Sometimes I get the feeling he's just laughing at us. The odd thing is that he's quite different from the rest of his tribe. We've got a unit studying them in the field, you know.
In what way is he different?
The others don't show any emotions at all, as far as we can discover. They're completely lacking in curiosity. You can stand beside them, and if you wait long enough, they'll eat right round you. As long as you don't actively interfere with them, they'll take no notice of you.
And what happens if you do?
They'll try and push you out of the way like some obstacle. If they can't do that, they'll just go somewhere else. Whatever you do, you can't make them annoyed.
Are they good-natured or just plain stupid?
I'd be inclined to say it's neither one nor the other. They've had no natural enemies for so long that they can't imagine that anyone would try to hurt them. By now they must be largely creatures of habit. Life's so tough for them that they can't afford expensive luxuries like curiosity and the other emotions.
Then how do you explain this little fellow's behaviour?
Asked Gibson, pointing to Squeak, who was now investigating his pockets.
He's not really hungry. I've just offered him some food. So it must be pure inquisitiveness.
It's probably a phase they pass through when they're young. Think how a kitten differs from a full-grown cat. Or a human baby from an adult, for that matter.
So when Squeak grows up, he'll be like the others?
Probably, but it isn't certain. We don't know what capacity he has for learning new habits. For instance, he's very good at finding his way out of mazes. Once you can persuade him to make the effort.
Poor Squeak, said Gibson. Sometimes I feel quite guilty about taking you away from home. Still, it was your own idea. Let's go for a walk.
Squeak immediately hopped towards the door.
Did you see that? Exclaimed Gibson.
He
He understands what I'm saying.
Well, so can a dog when it hears a command. It may simply be a question of habit again. You've been taking him out this time every day, and he's got used to it. Can you bring him back inside half an hour? We're fixing up the encephalograph to get some EEG records of his brain.
These afternoon walks were a way of reconciling Squeak to his fate, and at the same time salving Gibson's conscience. He sometimes felt rather like a baby snatcher who had abandoned his victim immediately after stealing it. But it was all in the cause of science, and the biologists had sworn they wouldn't hurt Squeak in any way. The inhabitants of Port Lowell were now used to seeing this strangely assorted pair taking their daily stroll along the streets, and crowds no longer gathered to watch them pass. When it was outside school hours, Squeak usually collected a retinue of young admirers who wanted to play with him. But it was now early afternoon, and the juvenile population was still in durance vile. There was no one in sight when Gibson and his companion swung into Broadway, but presently a familiar figure appeared in the distance. Hadfield was carrying out his daily tour of inspection, and as usual, he was accompanied by his pets. It was the first time that Topaz and Turquoise had met Squeak, and their aristocratic calm was seriously disturbed, though they did their best to conceal the fact. They tugged on their leads and tried to shelter unobtrusively behind Hadfield, while Squeak took not the slightest notice of them at all.
"Quite a menagerie," laughed Hadfield. "I don't think Topaz and Turquoise appreciate having a rival. They've had the place to themselves so long that they think they own it."
"Any news from Earth yet?" asked Gibson anxiously.
"Oh, about your application? Good heavens, only sent it off 2 days ago. You know just how quickly things move down there. It will be at least a week before we get an answer."
The Earth was always down, the outer planets up, so Gibson had discovered. The terms gave him a curious mental picture of a great slope leading down to the sun, with the planets lying on it at varying heights.
"I don't really see what it's got to do with Earth," Gibson continued. "After all, it's not as if there's any question of allocating shipping space. I'm here already. In fact, it'll save trouble if I don't go back."
"You surely don't imagine that such common-sense arguments carry much weight with the policymakers back on Earth?" retorted Hadfield. "Oh, dear, no. Everything has to go through the proper channels."
Gibson was fairly sure that Hadfield did not usually talk about his superiors in this light-hearted fashion, and he felt that peculiar glow of satisfaction that comes when one is permitted to share a deliberate indiscretion. It was another sign that the CE trusted him and considered that he was on his side. Dare he mention the two other matters that were occupying his mind? Project Dawn and Irene? As far as Irene was concerned, he had made his promise and would have to keep it sooner or later. But first, he really ought to have a talk with Irene herself. Yes, that was a perfectly good excuse for putting it off. He put it off so long that the matter was taken right out of his hands. Irene herself made the plunge, no doubt egged on by Jimmy, from whom Gibson had a full report the next day. It was easy to tell from Jimmy's face what the result had been. Irene's suggestion must have been a considerable shock to Hadfield, who no doubt believed that he had given his daughter everything she needed, and thus shared a delusion common among parents. Yet he had taken it calmly, and there had been no scenes. Hadfield was too intelligent a man to adopt the attitude of the deeply wounded father. He had merely given lucid and compelling reasons why Irene couldn't possibly go to Earth until she was 21, when he planned to return for a long holiday, during which they could see the world together. And that was only 3 years away.
3 years! Lamented Jimmy. It might just as well be 3 lifetimes!
Gibson deeply sympathized, but tried to look on the bright side of things. "It's not so long, really. You'll be fully qualified then, and earning a lot more money than most young men at that age. And it's surprising how quickly the time goes." This Job's comforting produced no alleviation of Jimmy's gloom. Gibson felt like adding the comment that it was just as well that ages on Mars were still reckoned by Earth time, and not according to the Martian year of 687 days. However, he thought better of it and remarked instead, "What does Hadfield think about all this anyway? Has he discussed you with Irene?"
"I don't think he knows anything about it."
"You can bet your life he does.
You know, I really think it would be a good idea to go and have it out with him."
"I've thought of that once or twice," said Jimmy. "But I guess I'm scared."
"You'll have to get over that sometime if he's going to be your father-in-law," retorted Gibson. "Besides, what harm could it do?"
"He might stop Irene seeing me in the time we've still got.
Hadfield isn't that sort of man, and if he was, he'd have done it long ago."
Jimmy thought this over and was unable to refute it. To some extent, Gibson could understand his feelings, for he remembered his own nervousness at his first meeting with Hadfield. In this he had had much less excuse than Jimmy, for experience had long ago taught him that few great men remain great when one gets close up to them. But to Jimmy, Hadfield was still the aloof and unapproachable Master of Mars.
"If I do go and see him," said Jimmy at last, "what do you think I ought to say?"
"What's wrong with the plain, unvarnished truth? It's been known to work wonders on such occasions."
Jimmy shot him a slightly hurt look. He was never quite sure whether Gibson was laughing with him or at him. It was Gibson's own fault, and was the chief obstacle to their complete understanding.
"Look," said Gibson, "come along with me to the chief's house tonight and have it out with him. After all, look at it from his point of view. For all he can tell, it may be just an ordinary flirtation with neither side taking it very seriously. But if you go and tell him you want to get engaged, then it's a different matter."
He was much relieved when Jimmy agreed with no more argument. After all, if the boy had anything in him, he should make these decisions himself, without any prompting. Gibson was sensible enough to realize that, in his anxiety to be helpful, he must not run the risk of destroying Jimmy's self-reliance. It was one of Hadfield's virtues that one always knew where to find him at any given time, though woe betide anyone who bothered him with routine official matters during the few hours when he considered himself off duty. This matter was neither routine nor official, and it was not, as Gibson had guessed, entirely unexpected either, for Hadfield had shown no surprise at all when he saw whom Gibson had brought with him. There was no sign of Irene. She had thoughtfully effaced herself. As soon as possible, Gibson did the same. He was waiting in the library, running through Hadfield's books, and wondering how many of them the chief had actually had time to read, when Jimmy came in.
"Mr. Hadfield would like to see you," he said.
"How did you get on?"
"I don't know yet, but it wasn't so bad as I'd expected."
"It never is.
And don't worry. I'll give you the best reference I can without actual perjury."
When Gibson entered the study, he found Hadfield sunk in one of the armchairs, staring at the carpet as though he had never seen it before in his life. He motioned his visitor to take the other chair.
"How long have you known Spencer?" he asked.
"Only since leaving Earth. I'd never met him before boarding the Ares."
"And do you think that's long enough to form a clear opinion of his character?"
"Is a lifetime long enough to do that?" countered Gibson.
Hadfield smiled and looked up for the first time.
"Don't evade the issue," he said, though without irritation. "What do you really think about him? Would you be willing to accept him as a son-in-law?"
"Yes," said Gibson without hesitation. "I'd be glad to."
It was just as well that Jimmy could not overhear their conversation in the next 10 minutes, though in other ways, perhaps it was rather a pity, for it would have given him much more insight into Gibson's feelings. In his carefully probing cross-examination, Hadfield was trying to learn all he could about Jimmy, but he was testing Gibson as well. This was something that Gibson should have anticipated. The fact that he had overlooked it in serving Jimmy's interests was no small matter to his credit. When Hadfield's interrogation suddenly switched its point of attack, he was totally unprepared for it.
"Tell me, Gibson," said Hadfield abruptly, "why are you taking all this trouble for young Spencer? You say you only met him 5 months ago."
"That's perfectly true,
but when we were a few weeks out, I discovered that I'd known both his parents very well. We were all at college together.
It had slipped out before he could stop it. Hadfield's eyebrows went up slightly. No doubt he was wondering why Gibson had never taken his degree. But he was far too tactful to pursue this subject, and merely asked a few casual questions about Jimmy's parents, and when he had known them. At least, they seemed casual questions, just the kind Hadfield might have been expected to ask, and Gibson answered them innocently enough. He had forgotten that he was dealing with one of the keenest minds in the solar system, one at least as good as his own at analyzing the springs and motives of human conduct. When he realized what had happened, it was already too late.
"I'm sorry," said Hadfield with deceptive smoothness, "but this whole story of yours simply lacks conviction. I don't say that what you've told me isn't the truth. It's perfectly possible that you might take such an interest in Spencer because you knew his parents very well 20 years ago. But you've tried to explain away too much, and it's quite obvious that the whole affair touches you at an altogether deeper level."
He leaned forward suddenly and stabbed at Gibson with his finger.
"I'm not a fool, Gibson, and men's minds are my business. You've no need to answer this if you don't want to, but I think you owe it to me now. Jimmy Spencer is your son, isn't he?"
The bomb had dropped. The explosion was over. And in the silence that followed, Gibson's only emotion was one of overwhelming relief.
"Yes," he said. "He is my son. How did you guess?"
Hadfield smiled. He looked somewhat pleased with himself, as if he had just settled a question that had been bothering him for some time.
"It's extraordinary how blind men can be to the effects of their own actions, and how easily they assume that no one else has any powers of observation. There's a slight but distinct likeness between you and Spencer. When I first met you together, I wondered if you were related, and was quite surprised when I heard you weren't."
"It's very curious," interjected Gibson, "that we were together in the Aries for 3 months and no one noticed it there."
"Is it so curious? Spencer's crewmates thought they knew his background, and it never occurred to them to associate it with you. That probably blinded them to the resemblance which I, who hadn't any preconceived ideas, spotted at once. But I'd have dismissed it as pure coincidence if you hadn't told me your story. That provided the missing clues. Tell me, does Spencer know this?"
"I'm sure he doesn't even suspect it."
"Why are you so sure? And why haven't you told him?"
The cross-examination was ruthless, but Gibson did not resent it. No one had a better right than Hadfield to ask these questions. And Gibson needed someone in whom to confide, just as Jimmy had needed him back in the Aries when this uncovering of the past had first begun. To think that he had started it all himself. He had certainly never dreamed where it would lead.
"I think I'd better go back to the beginning,"
said Gibson, shifting uneasily in his chair.
"When I left college, I had a complete breakdown and was in hospital for over a year. After I came out, I'd lost all contact with my Cambridge friends. Though a few tried to keep in touch with me, I didn't want to be reminded of the past. Eventually, of course, I ran into some of them again, but it wasn't until several years later that I heard what had happened to Kathleen, to Jimmy's mother. By then she was already dead."
He paused, still remembering, across all these years, the puzzled wonder he had felt because the news had brought him so little emotion.
"I heard there was a son, and thought little of it. We'd always been, well, careful, or so we believed. And I just assumed that the boy was Gerald's. You see, I didn't know when they were married, or when Jimmy was born. I just wanted to forget the whole business, and pushed it out of my mind. I can't even remember now if it even occurred to me that the boy might be mine. You may find it hard to believe this, but it's the truth. And then I met Jimmy, and that brought it all back again. I felt sorry for him at first, and then began to get fond of him. But I never guessed who he was. I even found myself trying to trace his resemblance to Gerald, though I can hardly remember him now. Poor Gerald. He, of course, had known the truth well enough, but he had loved Kathleen and had been glad to marry her on any terms he could. Perhaps he was to be pitied as much as she, but that was something that now would never be known.
"And when," persisted Hadfield, "did you discover the truth?"
"Only a few weeks ago, when Jimmy asked me to witness some official document he had to fill in. It was his application to start work here, in fact. That was when I first learned his date of birth."
"I see," said Hadfield thoughtfully. "But even that doesn't give absolute proof, does it?"
"I'm perfectly sure," Gibson replied with such obvious pique that Hadfield could not help smiling, "that there was no one else. Even if I'd had any doubts left, you've dispelled them yourself."
"And Spencer?"
asked Hadfield, going back to his original question.
"You've not told me why you're so confident he knows nothing. Why shouldn't he have checked a few dates? His parents' wedding day, for example. Surely what you've told him must have roused his suspicions."
"I don't think so," said Gibson slowly, choosing his words with the delicate precision of a cat walking over a wet roadway. "You see, he rather idealizes his mother, and though he may guess I haven't told him everything, I don't believe he's jumped to the right conclusion. He's not the sort who could have kept quiet about it if he had, and besides, he'd still have no proof even if he knows when his parents were married, which is more than most people do. No, I'm sure Jimmy doesn't know, and I'm afraid it will be rather a shock to him when he finds out." Hadfield was silent. Gibson could not even guess what he was thinking. It was not a very creditable story, but at least he had shown the virtue of frankness. Then Hadfield shrugged his shoulders in a gesture that seemed to hold a lifetime's study of human nature.
"He likes you," he said. "He'll get over it all right."
Gibson relaxed with a sigh of relief. He knew that the worst was past.
"Gosh, you've been a long time," said Jimmy. "I thought you were never going to finish. What happened?"
Gibson took him by the arm. "Don't worry," he said. "It's quite all right. Everything's going to be all right now." He hoped and believed he was telling the truth. Hadfield had been sensible, which was more than some fathers would have been, even in this day and age.
"I'm not particularly concerned," he had said, "who Spencer's parents were or were not. This isn't the Victorian era. I'm only interested in the fellow himself, and I must say, I'm favourably impressed. I've also had quite a chat about him with Captain Norden, by the way, so I'm not relying merely on tonight's interview. Oh yes, I saw all this coming a long time ago. There was even a certain inevitability about it, since there are very few youngsters of Spencer's age on Mars."
He had spread his hands in front of him, in a habit which Gibson had noticed before, and stared intently at his fingers, as if seeing them for the first time in his life.
"The engagement can be announced tomorrow," he'd said softly. "And now, what about your side of the affair?"
He'd stared keenly at Gibson, who returned his gaze without flinching.
"I want to do whatever is best for Jimmy," he had said. "Just as soon as I can decide what that is."
"And you still want to stay on Mars?" asked Hadfield.
"I'd thought of that aspect of it too," Gibson had said. "But if I went back to Earth, what good would that do? Jimmy'll never be there more than a few months at a time. In fact, from now on, I'll see a lot more of him if I stay on Mars."
"Yes, I suppose that's true enough," Hadfield had said, smiling. "How Irene's going to enjoy having a husband who spends half his life in space remains to be seen. But then, sailors' wives have managed to put up with this sort of thing for quite a long time."
He paused abruptly.
"Do you know what I think you ought to do?" he said.
"I'd be very glad of your views," Gibson had replied with feeling.
"Do nothing until the engagement's over and the whole thing's settled. If you revealed your identity now, I don't see what good it would do. and it might conceivably cause harm. Later, though, you must tell Jimmy who you are, or who he is, whichever way you like to look at it. But I don't think the right moment will come for quite a while."
It was the first time that Hadfield had referred to Spencer by his Christian name. He was probably not even conscious of it, but to Gibson it was a clear and unmistakable sign that he was already thinking of Jimmy as his son-in-law. The knowledge brought him a sudden sense of kinship and sympathy towards Hadfield. They were united in selfless dedication towards the same purpose, the happiness of the two children in whom they saw their own youth reborn. Looking back upon it later, Gibson was to identify this moment with the beginning of his friendship with Hadfield, the first man to whom he was ever able to give his unreserved admiration and respect. It was a friendship that was to play a greater part in the future of Mars than either could have guessed. Chapter 15. It had opened just like any other day in Port Lowell. Jimmy and Gibson had breakfasted quietly together, very quietly, for they were both deeply engrossed with their personal problems. Jimmy was still in what could best be described as an ecstatic condition, though he had occasional fits of depression at the thought of leaving Irene, while Gibson was wondering if Earth had yet made any move regarding his application. Sometimes he was sure the whole thing was a great mistake, and even hoped that the papers had been lost. But he knew he'd have to go through with it, and decided to stir things up at admin. He could tell that something was wrong the moment he entered the office. Mrs. Smith, Hadfield's secretary, met him as she always did when he came to see the chief. Usually she showed him in at once. Sometimes she explained that Hadfield was extremely busy, or putting a call through to Earth, and could he come back later? This time she simply said, "I'm sorry Mr. Hadfield isn't there. He won't be back until tomorrow."
"Won't be back?" queried Gibson. "Has he gone to Skya?"
"Oh, no," said Mrs. Smith, wavering slightly, but obviously on the defensive. "I'm afraid I can't say, but he'll be back in 24 hours. Gibson decided to puzzle over this later. He presumed that Mrs. Smith knew all about his affairs, so she could probably answer his questions.
"Do you know if there's been any reply yet to my application?"
he asked. Mrs. Smith looked even unhappier.
"I think there has," she said. "But it was a personal signal to Mr. Hadfield, and I can't discuss it. I expect he'll want to see you about it as soon as he gets back."
This was most exasperating. It was bad enough not to have a reply, but it was even worse to have one you weren't allowed to see. Gibson felt his patience evaporating.
"Surely there's no reason why you shouldn't tell me about it," he exclaimed. "Especially if I'll know tomorrow anyway."
"I'm really awfully sorry, Mr. Gibson, but I know Mr. Hadfield will be most annoyed if I say anything now."
"Oh, very well,"
said Gibson, and went off in a huff. He decided to relieve his feelings by tackling Mayor Whittaker, always assuming that he was still in the city. He was, and he did not look particularly happy to see Gibson, who settled himself firmly down in the visitor's chair in a way that obviously meant business.
"Look here, Whittaker," he began. "I'm a patient man, and I think you'll agree I don't often make unreasonable requests."
As the other showed no signs of making the right reply, Gibson continued hastily.
"There's something very peculiar going on round here, and I'm anxious to get to the bottom of it."
Whittaker sighed. He had been expecting this to happen sooner or later. A pity Gibson couldn't have waited until tomorrow. It wouldn't have mattered then.
"What's made you suddenly jump to this conclusion?" he asked.
"Oh, lots of things. And it isn't at all sudden. I've just tried to see Hadfield, and Mrs. Smith told me he's not in the city, and then closed up like a clam when I tried to ask a few innocent questions."
"I can just imagine her doing that," grinned Whittaker cheerfully.
"If you try the same thing, I'll start throwing the furniture around. At least if you can't tell me what's going on, for goodness sake, tell me why you can't tell me. It's Project Dawn, isn't it?"
That made Whittaker sit up with a start.
"How did you know?" he asked.
"Never mind. I can be stubborn too."
I'm not trying to be stubborn, said Whittaker plaintively. Don't think we like secrecy for the sake of it. It's a confounded nuisance. But suppose you start telling me what you know.
Very well, if it'll soften you up. Project Dawn is something to do with that plant genetics place up in the hills, where you've been cultivating... what do you call it? Oxyfera? As there seems no point in keeping that quiet, I can only assume it's part of a much bigger plan. I suspect Phobos is mixed up with it, though I can't imagine how. You've managed to keep it so secret that the few people on Mars who know anything about it just won't talk. But you haven't been trying to conceal it from Mars so much as from Earth. Now what have you got to say?
Whittaker appeared to be not in the least abashed. I must compliment you on your, perspicacity, he said. You may also be interested to know that a couple of weeks ago I suggested to the chief that we ought to take you fully into our confidence. But he couldn't make up his mind, and since then things have happened rather more rapidly than anyone expected.
He doodled absent-mindedly on his writing pad, then came to a decision.
I won't jump the gun, he said, and I can't tell you what's happening now, but here's a little story that may amuse you. Any resemblance to, real persons and places is quite coincidental.
I understand, grinned Gibson. Go on.
Let's suppose that in the first rush of interplanetary enthusiasm, World A has set up a colony on World B. After some years, it finds that this is costing a lot more than it expected and has given no tangible returns for the money spent. Two factions then arise on the mother world. One, the conservative group, wants to close the project down, to cut its losses and get out. The other group, the progressives, wants to continue the experiment because they believe that in the long run, man has got to explore and master the material universe, or else he'll simply stagnate on his own world. But this sort of argument is no use with the taxpayers, and the conservatives are beginning to get the upper hand. All this, of course, is rather unsettling to the colonists, who are getting more and more independently minded and don't like the idea of being regarded as poor relations living on charity. Still, they don't see any way out. Until one day, a revolutionary scientific discovery is made. I should have explained at the beginning that Planet B has been attracting the finest brains of A, which is another reason why A is getting annoyed. This discovery opens up almost unlimited prospects for the future of B. But to apply it involves certain risks, as well as the diversion of a good deal of B's limited resources. Still, the plan is put forward and is promptly turned down by A. There is a protracted tug of war behind the scenes, but the home planet is adamant. The colonists are then faced with two alternatives. They can force the issue out into the open and appeal to the public on World A. Obviously, they'll be at a great disadvantage, as the men on the spot can shout them down. The other choice is to carry on with the plan without informing Earth. I mean, Planet A. And this is what they finally decided to do. Of course, there were a lot of other factors involved, political and personal, as well as scientific. It so happened that the leader of the colonists was a man of unusual determination who wasn't scared of anything or anyone on either of the planets. He had a team of first-class scientists behind him, and they backed him up. So the plan went ahead. But no one knows yet if it will be successful. I'm sorry I can't tell you the end of the story. You know how these serials always break off at the most exciting places.
I think you've told me just about everything, said Gibson. Everything, that is, except one minor detail. I still don't know what Project Dawn is.
He rose to go.
Tomorrow I'm coming back to hear the final installment of your gripping serial.
There won't be any need to do that, Whittaker replied.
He glanced unconsciously at the clock.
You'll know long before then.
As he left the administration building, Gibson was intercepted by Jimmy.
I'm supposed to be at work, he said breathlessly. But I had to catch you. Something important's going on.
I know, replied Gibson rather impatiently. Project Dawn's coming to the Boyle and Hadfield's left town.
Oh, replied Jimmy, a little taken aback. I didn't think you'd have heard. But you won't know this anyway. Irene's very upset. She told me her father said goodbye last night, as if... well, as if he mightn't see her again.
Gibson whistled. That put things in a different light. Project Dawn was not only big, it might be dangerous. This was a possibility he had not considered. Whatever's happening, he said. We'll know all about it tomorrow. Whittaker's just told me that. But I think I can guess where Hadfield is right now.
Where?
He's up on Phobos. For some reason, that's the key to Project Dawn. And that's where you'll find the chief right now. Gibson would have made a large bet on the accuracy of this guess. It was just as well that there was no one to take it, for he was quite wrong. Hadfield was now almost as far away from Phobos as he was from Mars. At the moment, he was sitting in some discomfort in a small spaceship, which was packed with scientists and their hastily dismantled equipment. He was playing chess, and playing it very badly, against one of the greatest physicists in the solar system. His opponent was playing equally badly, and it would soon have become quite obvious to any observer that they were simply trying to pass the time. Like everyone on Mars, they were waiting. But they were the only ones who knew exactly what they were waiting for. The long day, one of the longest that Gibson had ever known, slowly ebbed away. It was a day of wild rumors and speculation. Everyone in Port Lowell had some theory which they were anxious to air. But as those who knew the truth said nothing, and those who knew nothing said too much, when night came, the city was in a state of extreme confusion. Gibson wondered if it was worthwhile staying up late, but around midnight he decided to go to bed. He was fast asleep when, invisibly, soundlessly, hidden from him by the thickness of the planet, Project Dawn came to its climax. Only the men in the watching spaceship saw it happen, and changed suddenly from grave scientists to shouting, laughing schoolboys as they turned to race for home. In the very small hours of the morning, Gibson was wakened by a thunderous banging on his door. It was Jimmy, shouting to him to get up and come outside. He dressed hastily, but when he reached the door, Jimmy had already gone out into the street. He caught him up at the doorway. From all sides, people were beginning to appear, rubbing their eyes sleepily and wondering what had happened. There was a rising buzz of voices and distant shouts. Port Lowell sounded like a beehive that had been suddenly disturbed. It was a full minute before Gibson understood what had awakened the city. Dawn was just breaking. The eastern sky was aglow with the first light of the rising sun. The eastern sky? My God! That dawn was breaking in the west! No one could have been less superstitious than Gibson, but for a moment the upper levels of his mind were submerged by a wave of irrational terror. It lasted only a moment. Then reason reasserted itself. Brighter and brighter grew the light spilling over the horizon. Now the first rays were touching the hills above the city. They were moving swiftly, far, far too swiftly for the sun. And suddenly a blazing golden meteor leapt up out of the desert, climbing almost vertically towards the zenith. Its very speed betrayed its identity. This was Phobos, or what had been Phobos a few hours before. Now it was a yellow disk of fire, and Gibson could feel the heat of its burning upon his face. The city around him was now utterly silent, watching the miracle and slowly waking to a dim awareness of all that it might mean to Mars. So this was Project Dawn. It had been well named. The pieces of the jigsaw puzzle were falling into place, but the main pattern was still not clear. To have turned Phobos into a second sun was an incredible feat of presumably nuclear engineering. Yet Gibson did not see how it could solve the colony's problems. He was still worrying over this when the seldom-used public address system of Port Lowell burst into life and Whittaker's voice came drifting softly down the streets.
"Hello, everybody," he said. "I guess you're all awake by now and have seen what's happened. The chief executive's on his way back from space and would like to speak to you. Here he is."
There was a click. Then someone said, "Sotto voce."
"You're on to Port Lowell, sir."
A moment later, Hadfield's voice came out of the speakers. He sounded tired but triumphant, like a man who had fought a great battle and won through to victory.
"Hello, Mars," he said. "Hadfield speaking. I'm still in space on the way home. I'll be landing in about an hour. I hope you like your new sun. According to our calculations, it will take nearly 1,000 years to burn itself out. We triggered Phobos off when it was well below your horizon, just in case the initial radiation peak was too high. The reaction's now stabilized at exactly the level we expected, though it may increase by a few percent during the next week. It's mainly a meson resonance reaction. Very efficient, but not very violent. And there's no chance of a fully-fledged atomic explosion with the material composing Phobos. Your new luminary will give you about a tenth of the sun's heat, which will bring up the temperature of much of Mars to nearly the same value as Earth's. But that isn't the reason why we blew up Phobos. At least, it isn't the main reason. Mars wants oxygen more badly than heat, and all the oxygen needed to give it an atmosphere, almost as good as Earth's, is lying beneath your feet, locked up in the sand. 2 years ago, we discovered a plant that can break the sand down and release the oxygen. It's a tropical plant. It can exist only on the equator and doesn't really flourish even there. If there was enough sunlight available, it could spread over Mars with some assistance from us. And in 50 years, there'd be an atmosphere here that men could breathe. That's the goal we're aiming at. When we've reached it, we can go where we please on Mars and forget about our domed cities and breathing masks. It's a dream that many of you will live to see realized, and it'll mean that we've given a new world to mankind. Even now, there are some benefits we'll derive right away. It will be very much warmer, at least when Phobos and the sun are shining together, and the winters will be much milder. Even though Phobos isn't visible above latitude 70 degrees, the new convection winds will warm the polar regions too, and will prevent our precious moisture from being locked up in the ice caps for half of every year. There'll be some disadvantages. The seasons and nights are going to get complicated now, but they'll be far outweighed by the benefits. And every day, as you see the beacon we have now lit climbing across the sky, it will remind you of the new world we're bringing to birth. We're making history, remember. For this is the first time that man has tried his hand at changing the face of a planet. If we succeed here, others will do the same elsewhere. In the ages to come, whole civilizations on worlds of which we've never heard will owe their existence to what we've done tonight. That's all I've got to say now. Perhaps you may regret the sacrifice we've had to make to bring life to this world again. But remember this. Though Mars has lost a moon, it's gained a sun. And who can doubt which is the more valuable? And now, good night to you all." But no one in Port Lowell went back to sleep. As far as the city was concerned, the night was over and the new day had dawned. It was hard to take one's eyes off that tiny golden disk as it climbed steadily up the sky, its warmth growing greater minute by minute. What would the Martian plants be making of it? Gibson wondered. He walked along the street until he came to the nearest section of the dome and looked out through the transparent wall. It was as he had expected. They had all awakened and turned their faces to the new sun. He wondered just what they would do when both suns were in the sky together. The chief's rocket landed half an hour later,
but Hadfield and the scientists of Project Dawn avoided the crowds by coming into the city on foot through Dome 7 and sending the transport onto the main entrance as a decoy. This ruse worked so well that they were all safely indoors before anyone realized what had happened or could start celebrations which they were too tired to appreciate. However, this did not prevent numerous private parties forming all over the city, parties at which everyone tried to claim that they had known what Project Dawn was all the time. Phobos was approaching the zenith, much nearer and therefore much warmer than it had been on rising, when Gibson and Jimmy met their crewmates in the crowd that had good-naturedly but firmly insisted to George that he had better open up the bar. Each party claimed it had only homed on this spot because it was sure it would find the other there. Hilton, who as chief engineer might be expected to know more about nucleonics than anyone else in the assembly, was soon pushed to the fore and asked to explain just what had happened. He modestly denied his competence to do anything of the sort. "What they've done up on Phobos," he protested, "is years ahead of anything I ever learned at college. Why, even meson reactions hadn't been discovered then, let alone how to harness them. In fact, I don't think anyone on Earth knows how to do that, even now. It must be something that Mars has learned for itself."
"Do you mean to tell me," said Bradley, "that Mars is ahead of Earth in nuclear physics, or anything else for that matter?"
This remark nearly caused a riot, and Bradley's colleagues had to rescue him from the indignant colonists, which they did in a somewhat leisurely fashion. When peace had been restored, Hilton nearly put his foot in it by remarking,
"Of course you know that a lot of Earth's best scientists have been coming here in the last few years, so it's not as surprising as you might think."
The statement was perfectly true, and Gibson remembered the remark that Whittaker had made to him that very morning. Mars had been a lure to many others besides himself, and now he could understand why. What prodigies of persuasion! What intricate negotiations and downright deceptions Hadfield must have performed in these last few years. It had, perhaps, been not too difficult to attract the really first-rate minds. They could appreciate the challenge and respond to it. The second-raters, the equally essential rank and file of science, would have been harder to find. One day, perhaps, he would learn the secrets behind the secret, and discover just how Project Dawn had been launched and guided to success. What was left of the night seemed to pass very swiftly. Phobos was dropping down into the eastern sky when the sun rose up to greet its rival. It was a duel that all the city watched in silent fascination, a one-sided conflict that could have only a predetermined outcome. When it shone alone in the night sky, it was easy to pretend that Phobos was almost as brilliant as the sun. But the first light of the true dawn banished the illusion. Minute by minute, Phobos faded, though it was still well above the horizon as the sun came up out of the desert. Now one could tell how pale and yellow it was by comparison. There was little danger that the slowly turning plants would be confused in their quest for light. When the sun was shining, one scarcely noticed Phobos at all. But it was bright enough to perform its task, and for 1,000 years... it would be the lord of the Martian night. And thereafter? When its fires were extinguished by the exhaustion of whatever elements it was burning now, would Phobos become again an ordinary moon, shining only by the sun's reflected glory? Gibson knew that it would not matter. Even in a century, it would have done its work, and Mars would have an atmosphere which it would not lose again for geological ages. When at last Phobos guttered and died, the science of that distant day would have some other answer. Perhaps an answer as inconceivable to this age as the detonation of a world would have been only a century ago. For a little while, as the first day of the new age grew to maturity, Gibson watched his double shadow lying upon the ground. Both shadows pointed to the west. But though one scarcely moved, the fainter lengthened even as he watched, becoming more and more difficult to see, until at last it was snuffed out as Phobos dropped down below the edge of Mars. Its sudden disappearance reminded Gibson abruptly of something that he, and most of Port Lowell, had forgotten in the last few hours' excitement. By now the news would have reached Earth. Perhaps, though he wasn't sure of this, Mars must now be spectacularly brighter in terrestrial skies. In a very short time, Earth would be asking some extremely pointed questions. Chapter 16. It was one of those little ceremonies so beloved by the TV newsreels. Hadfield and all his staff were gathered in a tight group at the edge of the clearing, with the domes of Port Lowell rising behind them. It was, thought the cameraman, a nicely composed picture, though the constantly changing double illumination made things a little difficult. He got the cue from the control room and started to pan from left to right to give the viewers a bit of movement before the real business began. Not that there was really much to see. The landscape was so flat, and they'd miss all its interest in this monochrome transmission. One couldn't afford the bandwidth for colour on a live transmission all the way to Earth. Even on black and white, it was none too easy. He had just finished exploring the scene when he got the order to swing back to Hadfield, who was now making a little speech. That was going out on the other sound channel, and he couldn't hear it, though in the control room it would be mated to the picture he was sending. Anyway, he knew just what the chief would be saying. He'd heard it all before. Mayor Whittaker handed over the shovel on which he had been gracefully leaning for the last 5 minutes, and Hadfield began to tip in the sand until he had covered the roots of the tall, drab Martian plant standing there, held upright in its wooden frame. The air weed, as it was now universally called, was not a very impressive object. It scarcely looked strong enough to stand upright, even under this low gravity. It certainly didn't look as if it could control the future of a planet. Hadfield had finished his token gardening. Someone else could complete the job and fill in the hole. The planting team was already hovering in the background, waiting for the bigwigs to clear out of the way so that they could get on with their work. There was a lot of handshaking and backslapping. Hadfield was hidden by the crowd that had gathered round him. The only person who wasn't taking the slightest notice of all this was Gibson's pet Martian, who was rocking on his haunches like one of those weighted dolls that always come the same way up, however you put them down. The cameraman swung towards him and zoomed to a close-up. It would be the first time anyone on Earth would have seen a real Martian, at least in a live program like this. Hello? What was he up to? Something had caught his interest. The twitching of those huge membranous ears gave him away. He was beginning to move in short, cautious hops. The cameraman chased him and widened the field at the same time to see where he was going. No one else had noticed that he'd begun to move. Gibson was still talking to Whittaker and seemed to have completely forgotten his pet. So that was the game. This was going to be good. The folk back on Earth would love it. Would he get there before he was spotted? Yes, he'd made it. With one final bound, he hopped down into the little pit, and the small triangular beak began to nibble at the slim Martian plant that had just been placed there with such care. No doubt he thought it so kind of his friends to go to all this trouble for him. Or did he really know he was being naughty? That devious approach had been so skillful that it was hard to believe it was done in complete innocence. Anyway, the cameraman wasn't going to spoil his fun. It would make too good a picture. He cut for a moment back to Hadfield and company, still congratulating themselves on the work which Squeak was rapidly undoing. It was too good to last. Gibson spotted what was happening and gave a great yell which made everyone jump. Then he raced towards Squeak, who did a quick look round, decided that there was nowhere to hide, and just sat still with an air of injured innocence. He let himself be led away quietly, not aggravating his offence by resisting the forces of the law when Gibson grabbed one of his ears and tugged him away from the scene of the crime. A group of experts then gathered anxiously around the airweed, and to everyone's relief, it was soon decided that the damage was not fatal. It was a trivial incident, which no one would have imagined to have any consequences beyond the immediate moment. Yet though he never realized the fact, it was to inspire one of Gibson's most brilliant and fruitful ideas. Life for Martian Gibson had suddenly become very complicated and intensely interesting. He had been one of the first to see Hadfield after the inception of Project Dawn. The CE had called for him, but had been able to give him only a few minutes of his time. That, however, had been enough to change the pattern of Gibson's future.
"I'm sorry I had to keep you waiting," Hadfield said. "But I got the reply from Earth only just before I left. The answer is that you can stay here if you can be absorbed into our administrative structure, to use the official jargon. As the future of our administrative structure depended somewhat largely on Project Dawn, I thought it best to leave the matter until I got back home."
The weight of uncertainty had lifted from Gibson's mind. It was all settled now. Even if he had to make a mistake, and he did not believe he had, there was now no going back. He had thrown in his lot with Mars. He would be part of the colony in its fight to regenerate this world that was now stirring sluggishly in its sleep.
"And what job have you got for me?"
Gibson asked a little anxiously.
"I've decided to regularize your unofficial status," said Hadfield with a smile. "What do you mean?" "Do you remember what I said at our very first meeting? I asked you to help us by giving Earth not the mere facts of the situation, but also some idea of our goals and, I suppose you could call it, the spirit we've built up here on Mars. You've done well, despite the fact that you didn't know about the project on which we'd set our greatest hopes. I'm sorry I had to keep Dawn from you, but it would have made your job much harder if you'd known our secret and weren't able to say anything. Don't you agree?"
Gibson had not thought of it in that light, but it certainly made sense.
"I've been very interested," Hadfield continued, "to see what results your broadcasts and articles have had. You may not know that we've got a delicate method of testing this."
"How?" asked Gibson in surprise.
"Can't you guess? Every week about 10,000 people scattered all over Earth decide they want to come here, and something like 3% pass the preliminary tests. Since your articles started appearing regularly, that figure's gone up to 15,000 a week, and it's still rising."
"Oh," said Gibson very thoughtfully. He gave an abrupt little laugh.
"I also seem to remember," he added, "that you didn't want me to come here in the first place." "We all make mistakes, but I've learned to profit by mine," smiled Hadfield. "To sum it all up, what I'd like you to do is to lead a small section which, frankly, will be our propaganda department. Of course, we'll think of a nicer name for it. Your job will be to sell Mars. The opportunities are far greater now that we've really got something to put in our shop window. If we can get enough people clamoring to come here, then Earth will be forced to provide the shipping space. And the quicker that's done, the sooner we can promise Earth we'll be standing on our own feet. What do you say?"
Gibson felt a fleeting disappointment. Looked at from one point of view, this wasn't much of a change. But the CE was right. He could be of greater use to Mars in this way than in any other.
"I can do it," he said. "Give me a week to sort out my terrestrial affairs and clear up my outstanding commitments."
A week was somewhat optimistic, he thought, but that should break the back of the job. He wondered what Ruth was going to say. She'd probably think he was mad, and she'd probably be right.
"The news that you're going to stay here," said Hadfield with satisfaction, "will cause a lot of interest and will be quite a boost to our campaign. You've no objection to our announcing it right away?"
"I don't think so."
"Good. Whittaker would like to have a word with you now about the detailed arrangements. You realize, of course, that your salary will be that of a Class II administrative officer of your age."
"Naturally, I've looked into that," said Gibson.
He did not add, because it was unnecessary, that this was largely of theoretical interest. His salary on Mars, though less than a tenth of his total income, would be quite adequate for a comfortable standard of living on a planet where there were very few luxuries. He was not sure just how he could use his terrestrial credits, but no doubt they could be employed to squeeze something through the shipping bottleneck. After a long session with Whittaker, who nearly succeeded in destroying his enthusiasm with laments about lack of staff and accommodation, Gibson spent the rest of the day writing dozens of radiograms. The longest was to Ruth, and was chiefly, but by no means wholly, concerned with business affairs. Ruth had often commented on the startling variety of things she did for her 10%, and Gibson wondered what she was going to say to this request that she keep an eye on one James Spencer, and generally look after him when he was in New York, which, since he was completing his studies at MIT, might be fairly often. It would have made matters much simpler if he could have told her the facts. She would probably guess them anyway. But that would be unfair to Jimmy. Gibson had made up his mind that he would be the first to know. There were times when the strain of not telling him was so great that he felt almost glad they would soon be departing. Yet Hadfield, as usual, had been right. He had waited a generation. He must wait a little longer yet. To reveal himself now might leave Jimmy confused and hurt, might even cause the breakdown of his engagement to Irene. The time to tell him would be when they had been married and, Gibson hoped, were still insulated from any shocks which the outside world might administer. It was ironic that, having found his son so late, he must now lose him again. Perhaps that was part of the punishment for the selfishness and lack of courage, to put it no more strongly, he had shown 20 years ago. That the past must bury itself, he must think of the future now. Jimmy would return to Mars as soon as he could, there was no doubt of that. And even if he had missed the pride and satisfaction of parenthood, there might be compensations later in watching his grandchildren come into the world he was helping to remake. For the first time in his life, Gibson had a future to which he could look forward with interest and excitement. A future which would not be merely a repetition of the past. Earth hurled its thunderbolt 4 days later. The first Gibson knew about it was when he saw the headline across the front page of the Martian Times. For a moment, the two words staring back at him were so astounding that he forgot to read on. Hadfield recalled. We have just received news that the Interplanetary Development Board has requested the chief executive to return to Earth on the Ares, which leaves Deimos in 4 days. No reason is given. That was all, but it would set Mars ablaze. No reason was given, and none was necessary. Everyone knew exactly why Earth wanted to see Warren Hadfield. What do you think of this? Gibson asked Jimmy as he passed the paper across the breakfast table.
Good Lord! Gasped Jimmy. There'll be trouble now. What do you think he'll do?
What can he do?
Well, he can refuse to go. Everyone here would certainly back him up.
That would only make matters worse. He'll go, all right. Hadfield isn't the sort of man to run away from a fight.
Jimmy's eyes suddenly brightened. That means that Irene will be going, too.
Trust you to think of that, laughed Gibson. I suppose you hope it will be an ill wind blowing the pair of you some good, but don't count on it. Hadfield might leave Irene behind.
He thought this very unlikely. When the chief returned, he would need all the moral support he could get. Despite the amount of work he had awaiting him, Gibson paid one brief call to admin, where he found everyone in a state of mingled indignation and suspense. Indignation because of Earth's cavalier treatment of the chief. Suspense because no one yet knew what action he was going to take. Hadfield had arrived early that morning, and so far had not seen anyone except Whittaker and his private secretary. Those who had caught a glimpse of him stated that for a man who was technically about to be recalled in disgrace, he looked remarkably cheerful. Gibson was thinking over this news as he made a detour towards the biology lab. He had missed seeing his little Martian friend for 2 days and felt rather guilty about it. As he walked slowly along Regent Street, he wondered what sort of defense Hadfield would be able to put up. Now he understood that remark that Jimmy had overheard. Would success excuse everything? Success was still a long way off. As Hadfield had said, to bring Project Dawn to its conclusion would take half a century, even assuming the maximum assistance from Earth. It was essential to secure that support, and Hadfield would do his utmost not to antagonize the home planet. The best that Gibson could do to support him would be to provide long-range covering fire from his propaganda department. Squeak, as usual, was delighted to see him, though Gibson returned his greeting somewhat absent-mindedly. As he invariably did, he proffered Squeak a fragment of airweed from the supply kept in the lab. That simple action must have triggered something in his subconscious mind, for he suddenly paused, then turned to the chief biologist.
"I've just had a wonderful idea," he said. "You know, you were telling me about the tricks you've been able to teach Squeak."
"Teach him? The problem now is to stop him learning them."
"You also said you were fairly sure the Martians could communicate with each other, didn't you?"
"Well, our field parties proved that they can pass on simple thoughts. And even some abstract ideas, like colour. That doesn't prove much, of course. Bees can do the same."
"Then tell me what you think of this. Why shouldn't we teach them to cultivate the airweed for us? You see what a colossal advantage they've got. They can go anywhere on Mars they please, while we'd have to do everything with machines. They needn't know what they're doing, of course. We'd simply provide them with the shoots. It does propagate that way, doesn't it? Teach them the necessary routine and reward them afterwards."
"Just a moment. It's a pretty idea, but haven't you overlooked some practical points? I think we could train them in the way you suggest. We've certainly learned enough about their psychology for that. But may I point out that there are only 10 known specimens, including Squeak?"
"I hadn't overlooked that," said Gibson impatiently. "I simply don't believe the group I found is the only one in existence. That would be a quite incredible coincidence. Certainly they're rather rare, but there must be hundreds, if not thousands, of them over the planet. I'm going to suggest a photo reconnaissance of all the airweed forests. We should have no difficulty in spotting their clearings. But in any case, I'm taking the long-term view. Now that they've got far more favorable living conditions, they'll start to multiply rapidly, just as the Martian plant life's already doing. Remember, even if we left it to itself, the airweed would cover the equatorial regions in 400 years, according to your own figures. With the Martians and us to help it spread, we might cut years off Project Dawn."
The biologist shook his head doubtfully, but began to do some calculations on a scribbling pad. When he had finished, he pursed his lips.
Well, he said, "I can't actually prove it's impossible. There are too many unknown factors, including the most important one of all, the Martians' reproduction rate. Incidentally, I suppose you know that they're marsupials. That's just been confirmed."
"You mean like kangaroos?"
"Yes. Junior lives undercover until he's a big enough boy to go out into the cold, hard world. We think several of the females are carrying babies, so they may reproduce yearly. And since Squeak was the only infant we found, that means they must have a terrifically high death rate, which isn't surprising in this climate."
"Just the conditions we want," exclaimed Gibson. "Now there'll be nothing to stop them multiplying, providing we see they get all the food they need."
"Do you want to breed Martians or cultivate airweed?" challenged the biologist.
"Both," grinned Gibson. "They go together like fish and chips or ham and eggs."
"Don't,"
pleaded the other with such a depth of feeling that Gibson apologized at once for his lack of tact. He had forgotten that no one on Mars had tasted such things for years. The more Gibson thought about his new idea, the more it appealed to him. Despite the pressure of his personal affairs, he found time to write a memorandum to Hadfield on the subject, and hoped that the CE would be able to discuss it with him before returning to Earth. There was something inspiring in the thought of regenerating not only a world, but also a race which might be older than man. Gibson wondered how the changed climatic conditions of 100 years hence would affect the Martians. If it became too warm for them, they could easily migrate north or south, if necessary, into the subpolar regions where Phobos was never visible.